Have our marshal show you how we're going to keep time when we operate on Zoom. When it's time for you to begin, you will see in the top corner of your screen a green SCART card. When you have 5 minutes left to go, you will see a yellow 5-minute card. And when it's time for you to conclude, you will see a red stop card. I will always let you answer a pending question of a justice, even though the red card is up. But I will pretty much rein you in on your argument thereafter. So with those comments, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. So I'll call our first case, State versus Christian. Attorney Roy, will you begin, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Attorney Stephen Roy for Mr. Christian. Today we're here to ask the court a very simple but complicated question. Does the consumption of a legal intoxicant, i.e. alcohol, void Mr. Christian's right to carry a firearm? We think the answer is no. In looking into this question, the first step is considering whether the consumption of alcohol and the statute and the regulation falls within the scope of the amendment. The answer to this question is yes. The scope of the Second Amendment is defined in Heller, and Heller very clearly references and says that the meaning of the operative clause is, quote, putting together these textual elements, we find they guarantee the individual right to possess and carry weapons in the case of confrontation. Mr. Christian did just this. He carried his firearm and he actually was in confrontation at that moment. The second step
also, isn't that last statement of yours contrary to the facts found by the jury? Didn't the jury find on two occasions beyond a reasonable doubt that the state has proved he was not operating in self-defense?
Well, Your Honor, first I would like to note the difference between confrontation and self-defense. The purpose of the Second Amendment is guaranteeing the right to carry in case of confrontation. That doesn't mean it has to be in actual self-defense at the moment. The right is broader than just self-defense at the moment. Secondly, we spent a long time in our reply brief addressing this. The jury was not asked, did he act in self-defense? They were asked, did he act in lawful self-defense? And the circuit court put a number of restrictions on what lawful self-defense was and asked the jury to find at multiple stages if they believed Mr. Christian's actions were reasonable. Reasonableness is not the touchstone or the test for the Second Amendment. And as the Heller court informed us, a constitutional guarantee that's subject to future judges' assessments of its usefulness or reasonableness is no guarantee at all. Constitutional rights are enshrined at the moment they're adopted, and it's not left to the branches of the government, even the third branch, to later determine whether that scope was too broad or not. So the fact that the jury was posed this question of multiple stages of reasonableness and restrictions really doesn't go to whether or not Mr. Christian was carrying in case of confrontation. It was just simply the jury found that they didn't believe his actions were reasonable, which is not a constitutional test.
Thank you.
Attorney Roy, will you address the issue that your client wasn't deprived of the right to possess a firearm, right? He could still possess it. He just couldn't go armed with it. So can you talk about the distinction, if there is any, between possessing and going armed with?
Your Honor, I think it's almost ticky-tacky at that level, because if he's possessing it, the state's criminalizing it. So he's faced with the choice of, I'm either going to commit a criminal act or I'm going to exercise my Second Amendment right. And so I think the statute at that point, it restricts his right. He's forced with the choice of committing a criminal act or exercising his right.
Well, except that he made a choice to drink, right? Or to be intoxicated, not just drink, but intoxication is the is the criminal. The criminal piece is tied to not just possessing a firearm. He could have had the firearm in his room and he would not have been liable, right? Or he could have chosen not to consume alcohol to the level of intoxication. So, I mean, how do you say that his rights, he's being deprived of his right?
Your Honor, it's an interesting question. I would note that when you mentioned if he's in his room, our case law defines possession as within his reach or within his ability to control. So if he's in his room there, the facts don't support this, but it could expand to the point where just being in the room while you're intoxicated fulfills a statute.
Well, that's where the go armed comes in, doesn't it? You said it's ticky tacky, but is it? Couldn't he have a good defense? I mean, I don't know that having, so if he's lawfully in possession of a firearm and he doesn't go armed with it and he's intoxicated, he's not breaking the law, correct?
Your Honor, I don't have the statute in front of me, but I believe it does include possession at that time.
Well, counsel, under our cases, we've interpreted, well, I haven't because I dissented from the ruling, but we've interpreted go armed with to mean, I don't remember the exact language, but if it's reasonably accessible to you, it's not on your person, but it's within your control or within your reach, then under the law, as this court has interpreted, that means that somebody is going armed with it. So using the facts we have here, your client was in his bedroom at the time he actually put the firearm on his person. But even if he had had it in a nightstand drawer, for example, it was within reach. Is that your understanding or not?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. And in fact, I believe we used the nightstand example in the Court of Appeals unsuccessfully, but I think that the proper construction of the statute is that anyone who falls asleep while intoxicated and has a firearm in their nightstand has violated the statute. And theoretically, if the state chose to, they could prosecute those individuals as well.
Justice Dallet, are you done with your line? Because I have a different area of inquiry.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Counsel, in your brief in a couple of places, and in some detail, you've outlined that there is no historical precedent for banning the possession of firearms due to alcoholic intoxication. Again, you say at page 16, there is no historical precedent which would allow the state to disarm otherwise lawful citizens simply because of inebriation. My question for you is, that sounds more like a facial challenge. And I wanted to clarify, are you bringing only an as-applied challenge to the constitutionality of the statute?
Your Honor, at the circuit court level, Mr. Christian's counsel only brought a facial or an as-applied challenge. I would have loved to see the facial challenge come up as well, but with the record we have, it's simply as applied. So I think moving to the test of which constitutional test to apply is the next step in the analysis here. And I would note that the federal circuit courts and the majority of state courts have applied a two-step means and scrutiny test, where the first step is to analyze whether the regulated conduct falls under the Second Amendment. If so, then they move to some form of means and scrutiny, dependent on the how close the regulation is to the core of the Second Amendment, as well as how severe the burden is. In 10 years of litigation, this has provided a really unworkable standard. You'll note that through different circuits, they can't agree on what the core of the right is. For example, the Third Circuit says it's the defense of the hearth and home. The Fifth Circuit says it's the right of a law-abiding the right of a law-abiding responsible adult to use a handgun to defend his or her home and family. The Fourth Circuit initially said it's the right of a law-abiding responsible citizen to possess and carry for self-defense. but then later restricted it to self-defense in the home by a law-abiding citizen. So even at the step of what's the core of the Second Amendment, the federal circuits are greatly confused. And then when they move on to the test is all over the place. I've noted a particular law article describing the doctrinal chaos this has led to. For example, in New York State and rifle in the Second Amendment, Second Circuit, they say that serious infringements are subject to only intermediate scrutiny. Non-serious infringements are subject to a rational basis test, and it's only strict scrutiny when the law substantially burdens the core of the right. In the Ninth Circuit, they say it could be intermediate or strict, depending on which day, which judges, which regulation. And the Seventh Circuit has gone completely differently and applies a sliding scale. They've refused to say intermediate or strict scrutiny and just used a sliding scale instead. This creates a body of law that does not lead itself to predictable decisions because your Second Amendment rights are subject to different tests dependent on where you are and which judges you might draw on a panel.
Are you familiar with the Roundtree decision that was issued last week from our court?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a general question then. In that case, we dealt with a statute regarding felon in possession. And the holding in that case, as set forth in paragraph 4, the analysis hopefully comes later because I wrote the opinion, around paragraph 25 and following. But our holding was we determined that Roundtree's challenge to the felon in possession statute requires the application of intermediate level of scrutiny. So since you're not familiar with the case, I'm not going to go into any further detail other than if you are able to opine if felony in possession would be different than the statute at issue here. Felony in possession, I think, is 941.29 sub 2.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Are you able to respond to that, or are you not?
I am, Your Honor. I would point to now Justice Barrett's dissent in Cantor v. Barr, where she lays out a large breadth of history relating to felon dispossession statutes. Ultimately, she concludes that felon dispossession statutes are likely to be upheld. She recommends more than intermediate scrutiny, but closer to strict scrutiny. So I think felon dispossession statutes are likely to be upheld almost categorically. And that's been the consensus view of all the federal circuit courts that I'm aware of have addressed the issue, as well as state courts. There is some question of whether an as-applied challenge could be successful based on the facts of the individual case and whether the felon dispossession can be remedied like voting rights are. So I don't think that the statutes are the same to the extent of that level, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Just to springboard off of that, Mr. Roy, can you speak to the fact then, I mean, of course, now Justice Barrett, it was in the dissent in Cantor. Can you speak to the fact that in the case we're talking about here, as soon as your client sobers up, he can, under the statute, go armed, or you get the exact language here. He can operate or go armed with a firearm as soon as he sobers up. That is, it is temporarily he is not allowed to handle a firearm when he's drunk. So that seems to be to me obviously less intrusive than the felon dispossession, where we are saying if you're convicted of a felony, you may never possess a firearm. Can you help me with that?
Absolutely.
Position of that?
I think it is a fair statement to say it's less burdensome. However, now we're running this temporal gambit of, gosh, you're in trouble now that you need to possess your firearm for an anticipated confrontation. But shame on you, you consumed a few alcoholic beverages during the course of your evening. Now you're no longer able to avail yourself of this right, unless we allow a jury to determine whether or not it's reasonable. So I think putting this restriction on, I'm going to pivot a little bit to United States v. Yancey. Yancey dealt with the illegal drug user who was in possession of a firearm. And the Yancey court analyzed it, saying that those who are addicted to illegal drugs are similar to felon in possession. But we've got a big difference in the illegal drugs, and the record established that Yancey was in fact an abuser and addict of illegal drugs, which could lead to a potential felony conviction later.
Well, Mr. Roy, let me push back on you. Because it's not illegal to be intoxicated in Wisconsin.
Correct.
But it is illegal to do other things besides go armed or operate a firearm. That is, you can't operate a motor vehicle while you're intoxicated. So I don't think that analogy necessarily works.
Your Honor, there's no constitutional right to drive a car. So I think there's a big gap in that. And while there is a constitutional right to travel, that's not been held to be any specific means of travel.
No, I'm talking about the parallel you're trying to draw to someone who's using illegal drugs. And my point is that drinking alcoholic beverages is not in and of itself illegal.
You're correct, Your Honor. And that's why we think that Yancey is distinguishable and that it necessarily requires a different result. So Yancey, the court upheld the restriction as it was illegal. There was an illegal portion which removed it from the gambit of Second Amendment. Whereas in this case, there's nothing illegal prior to picking up the firearm. Does that clarify the position?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we've asked this court to use a categorical approach in analyzing Second Amendment cases. And this is really what Heller and McDonald require of this court. So Justice Breyer initially proposed an interest balancing test in his dissent for Heller, and the Heller court explicitly rejected this, saying that an interest balancing approach subjects the constitutional guarantee to future judges' assessments of its usefulness, and this is no constitutional guarantee at all. It relies on vague ethical first principles to, and Justice Scalia's word, it's less subjective because it depends on a body of evidence rather than a variety of vague ethical, political first principles whose combined conclusion can be found to point in any direction judges favor. And I think that's really held true when we look at the body of case law that federal circuits have promulgated over the last 10 years. It's scattershot, it's over the place. Your Second Amendment rights depend on which court you're in front of that day. And so using the historical categories that Heller tells us to do and is confirmed in McDonald would relieve that tension of the different Second Amendment rights in the different circuits and requires us to look at the historical perspective and historical categories and make analogies. When the Third Circuit first...
Counsel?
Yes.
If I recall, the Heller opinion identifies the core right of the Second Amendment, something like this. it references responsible citizens. Let me see. It says the core right identified in Heller is, quote, law-abiding responsible citizen to possess and carry a weapon for self-defense. It seems to me that the intoxicated use of a firearm is antithetical to that which is referenced in Heller as a responsible citizen, a core right of a responsible citizen. Can you respond to that?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree that that is the core holding of Heller. That portion, that quote, comes at the very end of the opinion where the court is applying the earlier analysis of the Second Amendment to the particularized facts of that case. So what they're saying is the Second Amendment, as applied to Mr. Heller, who happens to be a law-abiding, responsible citizen who wants to use this to protect his hearth and home, that's the very apex of the Second Amendment, and no government interest could come close to voiding this. However, if you look at the entirety of the opinion, the Heller court spends 50 pages addressing what the Second Amendment means and very clearly states under the heading, meaning of the operative clause, putting all these textual elements together, we find they guaranteed the individual right to possess and carry weapons in case of confrontation. So I would argue that the plain text of Heller says the individual right to possess and carry in case of confrontation is the core of the Second Amendment, not the quote at the very end of the opinion that addresses the specifics of the case at hand.
I don't have the opinion in front. I have the opinion in front of me with all the separate writings, but can't quickly get to the very end of these many pages. Does that paragraph end in some comma? In other words, is that the summary of the conclusion?
The section I just quoted, Your Honor?
No, what I talked about, the responsible citizen. I have that written down in my notes. But you're saying that's not the holding, even though...
I would say that's not the holding, Your Honor.
Okay.
The quote of... And whatever it else leaves to further evaluation, it surely elevates above all interests of the right of a law-abiding responsible citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home. That's the end of the paragraph, and that's on page 635. What we believe the holding of the Second Amendment is comes on page 592. I think...
Under your reading of Heller, how could felon in possession of a firearm statutes be upheld?
Your Honor, we would have to look to the historical cases and the historical and tradition. And now Justice Barrett did this extensively in her dissent in Cantor v. Barr and ends up concluding that felon in possession statutes are historically supported. There may be certain felonies that need to be exempted as our list of felonies has grown extensively over the last 200 some years. So there may be some that would not be included. There may be some misdemeanors that would be included. And as applied challenges should be allowed to dive into those categories and to really continue to promulgate and explore the depth of the Second Amendment.
Counsel, since you haven't had the benefit of reading the court's decision in Roundtree, I'll let you know that the court declined to apply a historical analysis. It declined to apply strict scrutiny. And so you might want to focus your arguments on the application of intermediate scrutiny to your as-applied challenge.
Your Honor, our position for intermediate scrutiny is first that it's the inappropriate test. Assuming this court would apply intermediate scrutiny, I still don't think that the tailoring of the statute is sufficiently narrow to protect the state's interest. At the motion hearing, the state presented its interest as it's not hard to visualize a bullet or shotgun slug or buckshot passing through the windows or walls and causing injury. We'll give the state that protecting injury from a firearm operated negligently or inappropriately is a compelling interest. And the state should work to prevent the injury that's caused by that. However, the statute at hand is much broader than it needs to be and covers possession. So it becomes a prophylactic, which runs afoul of the Second Amendment. And there's statutes on the book already which prohibit the injury and criminalize unnecessary injury from the negligent use of a firearm or the actual intoxication. And the intoxication is absolutely a factor for a jury to consider in whether there was negligent endangering of safety due to operation of a firearm. So I think that even under intermediate scrutiny, the statute has to fail just because it's not narrowly tailored to the state's interest. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Attorney DeSantis, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
May it please the court, Nick DeSantis for the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Christian argues that the Second Amendment gives him the unqualified right to carry a firearm around his apartment, no matter how intoxicated he is, no matter how many other people share the living space with him, and no matter how many other people are lawfully inside. He is not correct. Wisconsin statute section 940.1.20 makes it a misdemeanor to go armed while intoxicated. This statute does not significantly burden the core Second Amendment right to armed self-defense, and it is substantially related to the important government objectives of protecting public safety and preventing the dangers caused by a drunken individual with a firearm. Therefore, the statute is constitutional as applied to Mr. Christian.
Counsel, let me present you with a hypothetical. Let's say that Mr. Christian, all facts are the same, except he's in his living room. He does not have a weapon on his possession, and he is the victim of a home invasion, not by his roommates, who obviously wouldn't be invading their own home, but he's subject to a home invasion. Somebody comes in, guns a-blazing, and threatens him. Is it the state's position that he then has the right to retreat to his bedroom to recover his firearm that he has locked away in order to comply with Wisconsin statutes regarding the prohibition on going armed while intoxicated? Because to me, that suggests that he has no right of self-defense because he would have no opportunity to defend himself. In fact, he could be shot dead as somebody invades his home. Could you respond to that hypothetical, please?
Now, Your Honor, I think I touched upon this a bit in my brief, but if a person who is, say, drinking to intoxication in their home, which there's nothing wrong with, is the subject of a home invasion, that person would be free under Wisconsin's self-defense privilege and under the Castle Doctrine specifically to retrieve their firearm and use it to defend themselves. The self-defense privilege.
Too late, counsel. Yeah, under the state's position under these laws, he has the right to retreat and go retrieve his firearm. But the point of the Second Amendment, as articulated in Heller, I think your friend on the other side refer to it as the apex of the right, is to defend oneself and one's self and one's home. He would not have the opportunity to do that if somebody came in pointing a gun at him, right?
Now, Your Honor, I think in answering that question, it's important to focus on what the definition of going armed actually is. Because going armed does not mean that he couldn't have a gun in the room with him. It doesn't mean that it would have to be locked away in a safe. It just means that it can't be within his immediate control and available for use. So he could have a loaded gun, I think, just a couple of steps outside of his reach. And if he noticed a home invasion occurring, he would be free to retrieve that gun and defend himself.
While somebody's pointing a gun at him. I mean, my point is, counsel, it's not really realistic in the home invasion context. And it deprives somebody of their right, which is the principal right or the most important right protected under the Second Amendment, which is the right of somebody to carry in order to defend themselves and their home.
So the question is whether there's already a gun pointed at him.
Okay. Yeah. Somebody comes into his apartment, in this case, pointing a gun at him. I mean, it's not realistic to expect him to say, hang on a second, I'm going to go get my gun, or to move at all because he could be shot, right? So he's basically being forced to choose between living and dying, or dying in both contexts, right?
Well, Your Honor, if there was, I would first point out that if there were already a gun pointed at him and it wouldn't be realistic for him to move at all, then whether his gun is, say, in a holster or a couple of steps away from him, I don't think would make much of a difference. It would be at most a 1 second of reaction time. But the other piece to this is we have to focus on, does the law substantially burden the right to self-defense? And I think on that note, I want to focus on Yancey, because I don't think Yancey is distinguishable in the way that Mr. Christian has argued. It is true that Yancey itself was about unlawful drugs, but that was not really the reasoning of Yancey in upholding that prohibition on firearm ownership. The reasoning in upholding that prohibition on firearm ownership was because a habitual drug user, due to the use of drugs, has a reduced level of self-control. Yancey spent significant time analogizing firearm bans on habitual drug abusers to firearm bans on those with certain mental illnesses that have always been seen as presumptively lawful, and explained as such in Heller. And it explained that this was largely due to the lack of self-control that person has exhibited and the inherent danger that creates. Yancey also focused on explaining that Yancey cited with approval a number of state laws that prohibited unlawful drug users or alcoholics from possessing firearms. Now, it's not illegal to drink alcohol, of course, but the fact that someone is an alcoholic, much like the fact that someone is an illegal drug user, demonstrates that lack of self-control that the Yancey court found so important. And in fact, Yancey even cited with approval a Missouri Supreme Court decision from, I believe it was 1886, that upheld the law analogous to 941.20 that prohibited someone who is currently intoxicated from carrying a firearm.
Counsel, you described it a little bit in your brief and here before us too, is does it substantially burden the right to self-defense? I agree at least at some core level that part of the animating motive for the Second Amendment was that, but that's actually not what the text says. And that would seem to be a pretty cabined view of what the Second Amendment is. It says the right to keep and bear arms. Bearing arms would be to have them on you. It doesn't say anything in the text about the right to self-defense. So I'm wondering if you might address that argument in terms of even satisfying the standard. Is that really the question? Is the question before us whether it burdens the core right to self-defense?
Well, whether it burdens the core right to self-defense is how this court decides which level of scrutiny to apply. That's, as Mr. Christian's counsel explained earlier, the first step in the analysis is to figure out whether the law in question substantially burdens the core Second Amendment right to self-defense.
Well, counsel, I mean, if I buy a gun because I like to go shooting and you have a law that says I can't go shooting for fun, under your an analytical framework that you're offering to us, if my motive has nothing to do with self-defense, then we're not within there. We're, let's say I don't even keep it on my, in my home, or I don't bear it. I just keep it somewhere else where I go shooting, you know, at a cabin or something like that. But a law that prescribes me from having it around. The Second Amendment, let me say more plainly, the Second Amendment may be at some core basis about the right to self-defense, but that is not all that the Second Amendment is about. Its text doesn't say that, and I don't think much of anything in the text or tradition or history of the Second Amendment, the founding generation, would limit it to that. In fact, the default is the other way, that you have a right, as the text says, to keep and bear arms. That's the starting point.
Correct. And I think we need to distinguish here between the core. I'm not saying that self-defense is the only thing the Second Amendment covers at all. And I don't think that's what any of these federal court decisions and the many state court decisions addressing this is saying. The question is, self-defense is simply the core right of the Second Amendment. And that's what courts use to determine what level of scrutiny to apply. And so I think the Marzarella court did a good job of explaining this, the Third Circuit, in sort of analogizing this to First Amendment restrictions. Now, content-based restrictions on free speech in a public forum under the First Amendment are subject to strict scrutiny. But we recognize that that's not the only thing the First Amendment covers. And so even more neutral restrictions, such as content neutral time, place, and manner restrictions, do fall within the scope of the First Amendment. They're simply not in, I guess, what you could call the core and are subject to intermediate scrutiny. And courts have sort of analyzed the Second Amendment in the same way, that Heller and especially McDonald described the central component or the core of the Second Amendment as armed self-defense. And so a law that substantially burdens the core right to armed self-defense is subject to strict scrutiny, or in the Seventh Circuit's balancing approach, something that's functionally equivalent to strict scrutiny. However, if a law does not substantially burden the core right to armed self-defense, it may still fall within the scope of the Second Amendment. If that simply means it's more easily justified. And so in your case of having a gun simply for shooting, not for self-defense, not keeping it in your home, a law that prohibited you from doing that would almost certainly fail intermediate scrutiny.
I would like you to talk a little bit about what the circuit court did in regard to the questions that were submitted for which the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that the state had proved he was not proceeding in self-defense at the time that the facts support the charges that were made. Would you do that, please?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, my question really goes to whether he was actually proceeding in self-defense in a constitutional sense. When I asked opposing counsel about that, he said, well, the circuit court so limited what the jury, or so described what the jury could find, that even though they found he was not proceeding in self-defense, you have to look at the criteria the circuit court gave them, and that criteria in and of themselves precluded an actual finding that he was not proceeding in self-defense because it was a reasonableness standard that the question was wrapped in. Does that help at all?
Yes. Okay. Now, I'd first point out that I don't believe Mr. Kristen objected to the jury instruction as it was given. And I understand that this court still has the discretion to address that issue if it wishes. I'd also point out that he was convicted of two offenses here. He was convicted of the going armed while intoxicated. He was also convicted of disorderly conduct. The self-defense instruction on disorderly conduct charge, which arose from this same incident. It was a little bit closer to the privilege of self-defense. It tracked that statute a little bit more closely. And I didn't really get a chance to respond to the argument raised in Mr. Kristen's reply brief that the jury instruction did not adequately protect his right to self-defense. But if I had, I would have argued that any error in the jury instruction was harmless. Because what's required under Wisconsin's self-defense privilege is that a person reasonably believes that their actions were necessary in response to what they reasonably believe to be an unlawful interference with their person. This court has explained in prior cases that pointing a gun at someone constitutes a threat of force that could fall under that umbrella. And I don't see why picking up a gun would be any different. But the facts of this case are pretty clear that not only did Mr. Kristen not reasonably believe that there was an imminent unlawful threat to his person, it shows that he did not even subjectively believe that there was an imminent unlawful threat to his person. Now, I want to address the facts leading up to this incident a little bit.
Before you do that, counsel, before you do that, I'm sorry, Chief Justice, did that answer your question? I don't want to interrupt the line.
Well, I'm not completely, but you go ahead. You may be wanting to ask something along the same line.
Counsel, I want to ask you again, going back to my hypothetical, because I think that the state is arguing, conceding that even in these circumstances of intoxication, a person has the right to wield the weapon, use the weapon, operate the weapon for purposes of self-defense. But I want to return to Heller. In Heller, the court actually adopted a phraseology, a characterization of the Second Amendment that was written by Justice Ginsburg in her dissent in the Muscarello v. United States case from 1998. And in that dissent, which again, the Heller court adopted, she wrote, "Surely a most familiar meaning is, as the Constitution's Second Amendment indicates, wear, bear, or carry upon the person or in the clothing or in a pocket for the purpose of being armed and ready for offensive or defensive action in a case of conflict with another person." And in the Heller case, they wrote, Justice Scalia wrote, "We think that Justice Ginsburg accurately captured the natural meaning of bear arms." So as I understand Christian's argument in this case, he's not saying that his right to self-defense was infringed. What he's arguing is that his right to be ready for a confrontation has been infringed. Can you tell me, what is your argument that the Second Amendment doesn't protect his right to be ready for a confrontation?
Well, the Second Amendment protects a responsible, law-abiding citizen's right to be ready for a confrontation, by arming themselves. However, by drinking to the point of intoxication, which is defined as his ability to handle the firearm is materially impaired, it is certainly reasonable to proscribe him from picking up that firearm for the couple of hours during which he's made the voluntary choice to become intoxicated, with the knowledge that he is able to keep his gun just a few feet away from his reach and may retrieve it if a self-defense situation does come up.
But that suggests a person has to choose between their lawful right to drink in their own home and their right to exercise their Second Amendment rights to be ready for confrontation.
Well, I think to answer that, I would again point to Yancey. And the Yancey court found it especially significant that the prohibition on unlawful drug abusers owning guns only applied when the person was currently an unlawful drug abuser. And the Yancey court said something along the lines of, Yancey himself controls his right to possess a gun. The Second Amendment, however, does not require Congress to simultaneously allow him to choose both gun possession and drug abuse. And so in recognition of the special dangers posed by an intoxicated individual who is holding a gun, Mr. Christen is free to drink and Mr. Christen is free to carry a gun. But the Second Amendment does not require the Wisconsin legislature to allow him to choose both at the same time. Now, unless there are any further questions, I will yield my time.
Okay. Any other questions? Very good. Thank you so much. Attorney Roy, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to start with the state's assertion on brief. In the Supreme Court, they first changed their interest to this very specific, from this very specific harm from bullets flying to a broad public safety interest. I take issue with the changing of the interest at this late minute and to move to an incredibly broad standard versus something that's actually specific. I think it's just hedging to try and place whatever restrictions they want into that category. I'm very skeptical of it. Likewise, I'm very skeptical of government quickly swallowing the entire right if it has this broad power to designate any group as dangerous and then there disqualify them to having a gun. That's quoting the Seventh Circuit, both Justice Barrett and Cantor v. Barr, and I believe it's pronounced Scoin. It's 614 F3D at 641. So I think we have to be very careful when we're allowing legislatures to designate broad groups of people as dangerous. And I think there is a certain absurdity to allowing that large category. As someone who's not particularly versed in firearms, I would not be a great user in a situation. However, compared to a police officer or well-trained firearm expert who's had extensive training, they're much more likely to make well-informed decisions even after drinking than I am as an uneducated and not comfortable with the firearm user. So I think...
Mr. Roy, what evidence is there in this record that someone who is trained in firearms is able to use a firearm in a safe way?
Your Honor, there's no evidence one way or the other.
Okay. Well, I think that's what I heard you just say. Perhaps I misheard you, but I do not see any evidence, nor do I know of any, that says that if you are highly trained in firearms, that if you are then intoxicated, that will not impact your ability to use a firearm safely.
Your Honor's correct, but likewise, there's no evidence in the record that someone who's using alcohol could not use a firearm safely. It's simply been assumed because the statute prohibits it. The state also was asked about the jury instructions that the circuit court read. And I pulled them up and there's four restrictions on the right. The defendant reasonably believed he was under an unlawful threat of imminent death or great bodily harm. The defendant reasonably believed he had no alternative way to avoid the threatened harm other than by going armed with a firearm. The defendant did not recklessly or negligently place himself in that situation in which it was probable he would be forced to go armed with a firearm. And the defendant went armed with a firearm only for the time necessary to prevent the threatened harm. We've addressed this extensively in the reply brief, and those are four restrictions that really pull down the right for Mr. Christen to a very narrow set of circumstances in which he could actually exercise his Second Amendment right. So I think when we're asking a jury of 12 people these questions, we're throwing the Constitution out the window with the Second Amendment, because there's four stages where if the defendant didn't act in the exact manner that the jury would like it to, the Second Amendment is gone. The state also talked about Marzarella as the decision that really initially brings the means and scrutiny into the Second Amendment. They talk about this in a footnote four, and they say the Heller court didn't specify, so we look to other constitutional areas for guidance. The first is a natural choice, and Heller itself invokes the First Amendment. The first quote the Marzarella court uses is just as the First Amendment protects modern forms of communication, the second extends. So what's missing in the is the Heller court also talks about the Fourth Amendment there, which is a clear set of categories of exceptions and exemptions to the Fourth Amendment. So the Marzarella court is picking and choosing the pieces it wants to justify the end of getting to a means and scrutiny. If I might finish.
You can finish your thought, counsel.
The other issue is that the court really overextended its analysis. The statute at question was whether it's illegal to possess a handgun with an obliterated serial number. The Heller court says the Second Amendment does not protect the weapons not typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. And at the district court level, the district court could not identify, and Marzarella did not assert any lawful purpose for that obliterated serial number. So the analysis should have stopped there.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you both for very good briefs and for a helpful oral argument. We are now going to take a break so that some other people can come into the Zoom format and begin our second argument. We are adjourned.